Well, did Boris Johnson get his parliamentary comeuppance? By the time you see this, you'll know. We decided not to wait to find out before recording the podcast. Why? Because it looks like everything that happens in Parliament is a complete charade when it comes to holding Boris Johnson to account. How much longer can the mother of Parliament stumble on like this? We look as well at the Rwanda detention idea. A revolting idea that could actually just be a wheeze to try to stir up left-wing woke revolt, all the better for Boris Johnson to capitalise on it in local elections he looks likely to lose. Is there anything more shameful? And we ask if it's okay that a landowner on a Scottish island can actually be preventing repopulation by simply refusing to give his signature to a land transfer.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Welcome to this week's Leslie of Riddick podcast. A delayed recording because we thought that
Weathered.
Yeah.
We thought we should wait for Boris Johnson to stand up and do his thing in the Commons. Then it got knocked on an hour. I've got to go for a booster vaccine thing. I changed it. I'm ashamed to say twice. I've messed these people around. Then with the later time, I was basically going to be struggling. And then I suggested to Pat, look, why are we actually even waiting for this? Because what's going to happen? You know, nothing ever happens. And actually, the measure of all of this, I think for a lot of people, will be nothing can't happen this time. You know, if Westminster, if democracy and the mother of Parliament's nonsense, if any of this means anything, you can't just have this being business as usual, more procedural stuff, you know, a lot of barracking, nothing particularly happens, then it gets knocked on to Thursday. They have a kind of vote on whether or not they can show contempt. You know, I've got to say at this point, baboons showing their arses to people comes very strongly to mind. And in fact, not just baboons. But none of that will happen, will it? You know, there won't be a walkout. There won't be, you know, I mean, it's just going to grind on and on and on because he can.
Yeah.
I mean, so we thought, why not just record brazenly just before Boris Johnson is about to stand up? And if we're wrong, dear listener, you will know that we should have waited.
Yes. So, well, because, I mean, we know what he's going to say. Because he didn't knowingly mislead Parliament, he followed senior civil service advice. In fact, the Director of Propriety and Ethics, Helen McNamara, she's been fined. You know, she was just doing what he was dealt. It's a minor infraction. You know, Tony Blair got a fixed penalty for a parking offence. And the one that really got me, there are bigger things, you know, the cost of living crisis and this the continual deflection onto the plight of the Ukrainian people and saying that only Boris Johnson, you know, being in power and he leading the Western world in this charge against the fascist dictator Putin, he's the only one that can actually be in power. When we all actually realise is that they're running scared about now that Dishi Rishi has been shuffled off into the sidelines and how long he's got to stay in office, we don't know. There is no obvious successor that the Tory party believes can actually lead them to electoral success.
Yep. All of the above. And I mean, there's another thing, actually. I don't know about you or anybody listening. I just can't bear listening to them anymore. You know, I cannot listen to them actually talking about the Rwanda detention stuff. I know we're coming to that. But I just, the second they start speaking about it, I feel complicit. I feel like I'm co-opted. I feel sick, you know, and I just have to switch it off because I'm not going to put my mind through somersaults for this.
No.
I'm not going to follow this paper trail of rubbish that they're creating in the full knowledge, as we've seen them do. And this Partygate thing just demonstrates it. They lie on instinct. You know, they get caught, lie, get caught, lie. It's so, hey, whatever we're thrown now, you know, that we're all taking so seriously. I'm glad some people are paid a fair amount of money to have to sit down there and listen to this and find their way through it. But I'm good turning to this point. They have to find a way through it. Or what is Parliament for? Why are we bothering sending anybody down now, actually? And we've discussed this all before. And I know people would say, well, this is a funny one to break your, you know, straw to break the camel's back on, you know, if it wasn't enough over independence. But, you know, the point had been made by SNP MPs very eloquently by Joanna Cherry, that, you know, they were elected on a platform of going to Westminster. So they couldn't kind of, they would need to stand again on a different platform of not taking their seats. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really? Now you get to this point, I totally take her point. But I mean, as far as the punter's concerned, everyone should be really worried in that's in politics now that none of us care anymore, almost. You know, that none of us are even waiting to see what they do. We're not waiting to hear Ian Blackford's scintillating speech. We're not waiting to sort of see if some SNP MP lobs in something from a curved one from the side. We've been here too many times now. Nothing ever changes with us. And I know people will say, God, how naive are you, woman? It's always like, it's like, this is how it's, this is it. This is, you know, this is Britain. Hello, you've been living in it for a long time. And I totally get all that. But there's something about this that's just almost like a last straw now, since it comes, it's just the absolute shame-faced brazenness of it now that you can actually lob in. You can start, just as you've said, you can start to make parallels with parking fines. You can start downplaying it. You can throw Partygate in round the back of a war like Ukraine, or a kind of, you know, insult to humanity like the Rwanda deportation thing. I mean, your left jaw, your jaw's on the ground now, and it ought to be on the ground. Anybody who's saying, you know, get over yourself, this has been like, you have to get angry about this, because otherwise your political nerve system is switched off. We need to switch back on. So here we are. And yeah, we could go through all the ins and outs of, will he get reported to this and will he get reported to that? And will that person, you know, themselves, were they at a party? And, you know, will they forward it to some other committee that will take 6 months to report? And will Boris then find another big thing to give them first so that it'll take a month or a year to report? I mean, why do we even waste our brain cells on this anymore? I wonder.
Yeah, well, what it is that I keep seeing people referring to, is this what Britain has become? You know, particularly with the Rwandan refugee situation. But what we've seen is, and it was Chris Johns I heard on another podcast referring to the fact that the British Constitution, totally uncoded, partially written, you know, and it changes with every piece of legislation, depends on the good chap theory of convention. And what it is based upon is the fact that people will do the moral and correct and ethical thing. And we've entered Trump land with Boris Johnson. We've gone through that, the looking glass, into the situation where lying is the norm, where misleading Parliament is the norm. And it's a fracturing of trust in the political system. And because of the first-past-the-post system, and because of the way that he has an 80-seat majority, Boris Johnson is only beholden to one electorate, and those are his Tory MPs. And they are not going to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's about it. I mean,
yeah.
I was listening to Kirsten Oswald on World at One. And, you know, good that World at One have spotted the third largest party and thought, you know, they might have some skin in the game on this one. But, I mean, again, there was no fight in it. It was kind of, this is an interesting situation. Not an interesting situation. It's scandalous. Yeah. And somehow, you know, I know that there's a trouble for people that they either get accused of sort of faux rage, which I'm sure, given the amount of outrageous stuff that's been going on in Westminster, you probably do end up at some point that you feel that you're on some sort of, you know, autopilot or inertia. But actually, again, the SNP have got to get some kind of result out of this. It's just not good enough to just stand around saying, well, we were there and voted, you know, for a contempt motion. I mean, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so
talking about real contempt, though, and I heard Lord Peter Hennessy, the crossbench peer, you know, eminent historian specialising in the history of governance, saying that Johnson had shredded the ministerial code and had turned the prime ministership into an adventure playground for one man's narcissistic vanity. He was angry. Mm-hmm. He was disgusted. you know, and he was not short in coming forward and saying what we believe. But it is a constitutional crisis, whether people recognise it or not.
Yes, and that if you do read, I mean, this then requires you to read the kind of stuff that most yesers listening to this probably don't read. But, you know, if you do look, Alex Massey, for example, yes. in The Spectator, the yes. very night of, you know, the discovery that he'd been fined, absolutely bang to rights. I don't think there was a single word in his column that I would have written differently myself, which right. is worrying, right?
Yeah.
But he just said completely, this guy has got, you know, is just a kind of barefaced liar. He's got to go. Now I know everyone will come and say, oh, but Alex, where were you when he did this, when he did that? Let's just stay with where we are at the moment.
Yeah.
For a lot of Tories, this has walked over a line. And I suppose it is, like, you know, as you say, this is now kind of Donald Trump land. And, you know, it's been a long drift, but the kind of brazenness of this is now enough for a lot of people to think that's just the end of it. And it's interesting that this should happen, as you say again, you know, when Rishi Sunak is obviously fairly toast. So, you know, there's people actually saying in black and white, he must now go from within the Tory establishment, such that you'd think there was actually two Tory parties in there, at least. And of course, if we did have proportional representation, there would be two Tory parties at least.
Yes.
But there's one that's still going on the One Nation stuff and sort of thinks it means it. You know, the Rory, the Tory kind of Tory. And there's another, which is just the Del Boy Tories, you know,
yeah.
sort of just whatever he said, as long as he's leader, that's 100% right. And Douglas Ross, obviously, you know, thinks he flits between the both, but clearly is happier in the Boris is just right camp. Yes. As it turns out. And I do wonder, really, you know, what the chances for the Tories are in Scotland. They were never looking good anyway.
No.
It looks as if the British Tories have just sort of thrown them to the wolves now, because how you manage to explain that on the doorstep? And there have been all these entertaining videos yes. and stuff of his attempts to try to sort of duck and weave. Ugh, you know, that's just the size of it. There is a schism developing now that is the kind of thing that if it's not resolved with the right person and the right person isn't available, may well deepen into a fracture in the actual party.
Mm. That's interesting, because I note that the Conservative Party whips have organised a mass get-together of Conservative backbench MPs this evening. So I don't know what they'll be whipping them in, I presume, to take the protect big dog line. Mm-hmm. I heard Dominic Grieve, you know, he was on this morning again, like Rory of the Tory. I mean, saying while Boris Johnson is leader of the Conservative Party, he will not vote Conservative again. You know, and I mean, I do have a difficulty, because Dominic Grieve, you know, despite his decency and my agreement on this, was quite happy to go along with all the legislation, you know, and the austerity plans that had been run before, you know. But on this matter, I mean, he does seem to have crossed the line. I'll be intrigued to see just how well Boris Johnson goes down in the leafy suburbs that have been currently held by Conservatives. There was a by-election for a local authority where the Liberal Democrat vote went up to 68%. Everybody else collapsed. Yes. Everybody else collapsed, but the Lib Dems won a traditional Tory council seat with a massive swing towards them. And no matter what they say, 80-seat majority or not, the one thing that these Conservative MPs will be bothered about is whether they can hold on to their phony baloney jobs with a general election up and coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then even once they get through tonight, and here we are, of course, brazenly assuming that it won't be very much, after that, Boris is off to India.
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
So that what a shame, probably won't be able to do Prime Minister's questions tomorrow. Which is the difference with today and tomorrow would be that he's there to answer questions, you know, whereas today's a statement and he'll get some degree of protection. And then there will be a debate on Thursday when, oh, dear, he's in India.
Yeah.
So there you are. You know, this is where why bother spending time on any of this? You're going to sound off in his absence. They'll have to, you know, the only point of vague interest will be what guy you wouldn't buy a secondhand car off gets put in his place, or will it be, you know, kind of integrity on a stick, Priti Patel, you know, standing in? Dear knows who actually, I mean, will stand in, and that person will get pummeled in his place. which is as close as you get to holding this guy to account. Independence.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, because and we go back to it, even if he was being held to account at Prime Minister's questions, we've watched it so often, Leslie, and anybody that listens to the podcast probably watched it and been absolutely horrified at the Yaboo Sucks University, you know, style debating chamber that it is, where questions are answered, or whether that were true, questions are asked but never actually answered.
But I think the thing that perhaps might have happened at this Prime Minister's questions is just what you're saying, that there might be some Tories coming out of the woodwork who throw googlies from behind them.
Yeah.
You know, that's what people will be looking to see now, whether or not there's a kind of building push against him with it, because as you say, it's the Tories that are run, you know, it's the Tory party that decide on the future of this Prime Minister, not the rest of us. But anyway, none of this will happen because he's in India deepening the long-term partnership between our countries. As we face threats to peace and prosperity from autocratic states, it's vital that democracies and friends stick together. He is some kid, you know. Anyway,
and talking about brazen, I mean, I don't know how to react to this, because some people have been describing the announcement of the sending of asylum seekers to Rwanda for processing a very banal word that hides the actual evil beneath it. And that's one of the things that has come out of this for me, is listening to Priti Patel about how managerial it was all, talking about partnerships and processes and teams going out and doing things. Do you think it was a dead cat, or is being thrown on the table to distract from Partygate? Or is it just another step on the way to abrogating our responsibilities as the United Kingdom, as a decent member of the world order?
Well, potentially all of the above. But I mean, I don't feel like I'm in any way, you know, as expert as the people that I met at a rally in Glasgow on Saturday, which I just so glad I got off my butt and got down there, because you actually get really charged back up again by activists who totally care about this, struggling with a PA system eventually, with, you know, people beginning to kind of have party stuff going on in all the pubs around George Square. And then this group in the middle of it trying to make their point, which they did with tremendous passion. I mean, yes, it very possibly is just a ruse, because it seems that so many people think that it will either get winged in the House of Lords and big sections of it taken out, and thus will have to go backwards and forwards, or that the courts might well get involved with it, that it actually is just illegal and will be brought down in various ways there. And that's why Boris Johnson spent so much time rattling on about lefty, you know, anti whatever it is, kind of, you know, just ambulance chasing lawyers who are sort of determined to see through right on woke kind of all that stuff. Because that's the bit when they eventually, either the House of Lords, and then it will be unelected, you know, members. And of course, you know, we would agree with that. But that's what he'll manage to turn around, despite the fact that the majority of folk in the House of Lords have been put there by Tory prime ministers like him. But anyway, you know, none of this in the moment, none of this matters. It's just how you can kind of manage to manipulate a single little sliver of fact. So, OK, he's going to say either the House of Lords, these unelected, who are they to override the House of Commons? Or he'll say ambulance chasing lefty woke lawyers, who are they to, you know, overturn what we think is, you know, the only way to cope with this massive influx? And then the Daily Mail picks it up and the Express picks it up. And for a certain sort of person, that in probably not this country, south of the border, that seems to sort of do the business somewhere. And the fact that you actually get, you know, are not able to proceed with it is very possibly a sigh of relief. I don't know. I mean, it's 120 million quid being put into it. Many people have done the maths and tried to figure out how it could possibly be done, and have figured out that it's bound to be more expensive than just dealing with people here. Of course, the moral point of it is it's not processing anymore. It's actually just a one-way ticket. 80% of people are successful at getting refugee status when they appeal against rejection. So this is not picking the people, the, you know, the single men or the people who in some way to these folk look in any way dodgy. This is just saying the cohort who come in through irregular routes, which, you know, which is everything except the creaking avenues that they've set up to certain mm-hmm. destinations. Those people will just en masse be put on the planes off to Rwanda. If they're successful in Rwanda, they get to stay in Rwanda.
Yep.
And if they're not successful, they get deported from there. So, I mean, I think everyone's up to speed with that now. This is just a gigantic ruse. And of course, all the evidence from the other countries who thought that one might work is that people don't sit there passively. I mean, if these guys have had the wherewithal to get their way right across continents, war zones, winter, the channel, whatever else they've done to get here in the first place, they're not going to sit in Rwanda waiting to be processed. They're going to basically jump ship and start that awful journey through Africa all over again. So what have you done? You've just moved the problem. It's like a child, you know, it's like, I can't, you know, if I can't see you, you can't see me. The problem mm-hmm. is off our register because we've put it somewhere in a corner and put a blanket over it called Rwanda. So, I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. But again, it really raises lots of questions about, you know, what can happen here, because what are MPs going to do about it? You know, there was some great speeches, actually, by Pauline McNeill and Paul Sweeney, two Labour mm-hmm. MSPs who were there. Really excellent speeches. And then actually Rosa Salley got up. She's one of the Glasgow girls who from Drumchapel High, who came here 20 years ago herself as a refugee. She narrowly missed. It's a damn shame she didn't actually get voted in as an MSP, because she is some speaker. She's now standing as a council candidate. And she was so courageous, because there was a kind of groove developing of, you know, all the opposition parties need to work together, which is absolutely true, that we need to get some joint strategies and, you know, all that kind of thing. And that sounds right. But she was absolutely came out and was actually looking at Paul Sweeney, who'd done an excellent speech, as she spoke. And she said, how can you believe that there is any solution to this other than independence? You know, she said, I don't want to be back here in 20 years with the same thing. And just by the way, I spent earlier parts of my life struggling against racist stuff put through by Labour governments.
Yes.
At Westminster. So don't come any of this stuff. You know, what we need to do now is be pushing through for independence, to have a fair, just kind of migration system and control of our own borders. And independence was right up there. And actually, how refreshing. In fact, it was an unusual crowd, because it wasn't, there was one guy standing with a big saltire, but it wasn't looking at the badges and stuff. Yeah. People weren't there for Indy. You know, they were there, absolutely. They were refugee network people. So there wasn't an immediate, you know, absolutely independence. There was actually people thinking about it. They were standing there thinking, okay. So it was quite a moment, actually. And I'm not saying that she's pushing back. Paul Sweeney was making the point that when Parliament's prorogued, as it normally is for a new Queen's speech, there might again be some way to sort of put pressure on. Not quite sure how that would work with all the other parties. And I mean, all power to their elbow. I'm not criticising that. But it was as if somebody had just actually, when she was speaking, had just walked straight up, pulled herself right up over the parapet and looked ahead, you know. Yes, it was a really, really great, great rally.
Yeah, because, I mean, our friend Priti Patel claimed in November 2021 the Nationality and Borders Bill we were spoken about was going to introduce safe and legal routes. And the Home Office have now come out and said, no, it doesn't. And it's a catch-22 situation that asylum seekers are caught in, Leslie. You have to be in the UK to apply for asylum. You have to take a safe and legal route, or you're here illegally. But there are no safe and legal routes to enter the UK. There are none. It ended when we, on January the 1st, 2021, when we withdrew from the Dublin regulations, which was part of the EU. So, and they keep throwing this other point out about first safe countries. There is no principle of international law that says you have to stop in the first theoretically safe country that you come to. And there are significant reasons why people wish to come to the United Kingdom, you know, because of family ties, because of language, etc. I mean, and I was, you know, sometimes you speak about anger. When we'd heard rumours about the Rwandan situation before, and when I heard it, I was absolutely incandescent. You know, you hear Douglas Ross talking about people being livid and people being furious and people being angry, you can understand it. I was disgusted and sick to my stomach when I heard about this plan to fly people 4,000 miles away to a country which is Schrodinger's Rwanda, which on the one hand, a few months ago, according to the UK government, was an appalling place for human rights. And now, because we're going to be sending people there, is great for human rights. Ah, but it's a bad place for human rights because what we're going to use Rwanda as is a threat to stop people coming across the channel. Ah, but once they get there, what we've identified from the Israeli situation where they reach the secret deal with Rwanda, there's only about four people of the people they sent there actually remained there, and the rest of them got out using, in many cases, people smugglers. Mm. You know, it is not tackling the root problem, which is why are these countries destabilized and why are people seeking to escape from them, and just take a look at our involvement and why these countries are destabilized. But it's you know, sick to the stomach, just puts it exactly the way I felt. But yeah.
Well, the speakers that were making at the rally were making a real promise. I mean, Sabir Zazi from the Scottish Refugee Council was saying, we have to turn every Rwandan flight into a Kenmure Street.
Yes.
So they were basically pledging with all the different networks to try to stop any flights going to Rwanda. Now, that's quite something to say, because many of them might go from Stansted. There was a bit of speculation about Prestwick, although I think it's still owned by the Scottish government. But, you know, indeed it could, as we've just sort of discussed, it could be that it actually is very hard to get this thing literally off the ground, and that there will not be many any people going. But, you know, the instinct of people from an activist sort of background is, how do we organise? Where are the planes? Let's stop them. And honestly, after so long dealing with, I'm not saying that the political instinct is wrong. It's a different one than the activist instinct sometimes. So that you have to, you know, you have to watch what you say, and you can't have stuff quoted back against you, and you can't look like you're law breaking. The activist thing is, let's just stop this. And actually, I can't tell you how much that re-energized me. I got my bus pass and finally and used it to get down there. I mean, literally, when I was going back up the road, I felt like I was flying, because it was just, it's great to connect with people like this. And I've every confidence that if there's anything that can be done in Scotland, the people who've been working on these networks, like Pinar Aksu, who was the young woman who called the rally from the Mary Hill, I mean, these guys will get something organised. And then I really hope people will actually do something about it, because it's not enough to retweet stuff and like and all that saying. Mm-hmm. When something happens, if it does come to this, you've got to get out there.
Yeah, but at the point that you made earlier, that was made at the rally as well, that independence is the only way out of this, and placing too much faith, as Andy McIver has done in his recent article in the Herald talking about the middle way, where he touchingly, I thought, said over to you, Labour Party, because he has no faith in the Conservatives, who believes they're stuck in this unionist just say no mindset, that he believes that there is a mandate for an independence referendum, and the way to actually knock nationalism on the head and the drive for Scottish independence, as it happened with Norwegian membership of the European Union and with the Quebecois separatists, is to have the referendum and have this other option on the cards.
Yeah, and actually, I've been reading some of Andy's stuff in the Herald, and you know, it's interesting, reasonable stuff. I'm sure a lot of people think, oh, come on, we're not back onto this again. You know, the sort of plan B, whatever it is, second question, middle option, whatever. And actually, I'm sort of surprised in a way, because Andy's a smart enough guy to realise that's just, it's a very weak kind of offer, mostly because it just isn't, you know, afterwards I thought, did I actually waste a whole column saying this? Because it's so obvious that it'll never be delivered. You can say what you like. You know, I mean, there is no way that any really useful entrenchment of power in a Scottish home rule, let's say, you know, Devo Max, whatever you want to say, none of that is going to happen. It just isn't going to happen. I mean, we can see why it wouldn't happen from the Tories' point of view. You know, they're basically going up that down escalator. They're just centralising stuff more. And there's no... Also, I don't think the political ecology of the Commons allows anyone to rethink its utter sovereignty, which you would have to do if you were to give Scotland a parliament that couldn't be dissolved at some point by aforementioned mother of parliaments.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, there's nobody feeling that way about it at all. Obviously, the list of broken promises just gets longer every time you, you know, spend 5 minutes on the news. And I would think that now, actually, I would guess that there isn't a person living in Scotland who would believe any pledge about Devo Max from Boris Johnson, because you just look at everything. You know, we've seen his modus operandi now. It's just pledge now, prevaricate or withdraw the entire thing later. That's the way they swing, you know. So it's not going to happen from their point of view. For Labour, well, you know, the problem is, we said before, is that even if Starmer does manage to form a government and somehow gets over his difficult pledge that there wouldn't be any kind of deal with the SNP, and that really is kind of like a tough one, how do you see a country, and this is England, with English voters still very committed to their Brexit stance, not huge amounts of buyer's remorse appearing yet, all forms of difficulty of Brexit contributing to the cost of living crisis carefully edited and removed from everybody's thinking in ways that makes me conjure up Orwell and such like. You know, it's so completely gone as a thing from all our public communications. So, you know, do you really think that actually, you know, this is going to be a government, if there is a Labour government, that will be doing any kind of giving back control to any other parliament? Brussels, Belfast, Edinburgh? No. If you win as Keir Starmer, you've wrapped yourself in the Union Jack. You've spoken endlessly about Queen and country. You've gone to as many army events as you can possibly do. You have basically become as conservative as the Tories with just a little bit of a kind of, you know, pro-worker edge. And that straitjacket will not disappear upon election, just as it didn't disappear when Tony Blair took office and didn't get rid of Thatcher's privatisations or trade union legislation. You know, all the basic changes she'd made sat festering in the corner, and only stealth manoeuvres were able to redistribute wealth during their governance period, which is going to be exactly the same with Keir Starmer. There's no way that anybody's going to see giving the Scots more power as a priority. They're just not going to have it. So it's kind of, I wish it would be just a nice thing, basically, if we could get to the stage where people who are intelligent, useful commentators like Andy McKeever, just please don't do this one again. I mean, you know, if we're going to have, when we have the next independence referendum, of course, some people will still decide that Scotland's better off in the union, warts and all. That's fine. But please don't pretend a middle way is viable. It's not on offer. It's just not.
I did rather like, enjoy, one of his final statements was that if there's one thing unionism needs, it's a positive vision. Yes. Unionism is struggling, not because the SNP is popular, but because the UK is increasingly unpopular. And I thought that was a telling statement. I thought, well, there's quite a lot of truth in that. And you've spoken about it before, that there cannot be an utter dependence upon the unpopularity of the current structure of the UK and the current Conservative government in order to see us through to independence. And looking at that in terms of what the Scottish government is doing, I thought it was a tremendously interesting piece that you wrote about Great Bernera and the struggles that the the Crofton community are having there. And I did love your, I love the statement. It's the first time I've heard it. Was a croft is famously a piece of land surrounded by legislation. And I thought that was superb.
Well, that's that has been said for decades. That is quite a truism within the kind of Highland community. But yeah, I mean, people. I think people might think, oh, small island, who cares, basically. But what happened was, I'm revising a book that I wrote 15 years ago. I can hardly believe it. Cycling Up the Western Isles, called Riddick on the Outer Hebrides. It's been reprinted several times. And then the publisher, Lewith, said, look, it's 15 years old. Do you not think perhaps you need to kind of revise it? Like some things might have changed. And since the book is very much about people, not empty landscapes, that was true. So I started looking through it, discovered to my delight, really, that the landscape that we cycle through has changed since that 2006 cycle. There is now twice as much land in community control after that date as there was before it. So that essentially, for most of the journey, you're cycling through community-owned land. Hooray. Yep. So just because Virgo might have been rising in my chart at that point, I just decided to be a bit pernickety and just look to make sure there was no wee places that I'd missed out on when I was creating my little totals of land. And noticed online that Great Bernera had looked like it was heading towards a buyout, and then there was nothing else. So I got in touch with some people, finally got in touch with one of the guys in Great Bernera, and discovered that actually they basically have ground to a halt, because the right to buy legislation works fine, basically, if you've got landowners that will play ball. And increasingly in the Western Isles, the landowners are not even just playing ball. Some of them have actually been ahead of the community by offering the land for free, actually, to crofters, because they basically get it, you know. But if you get somebody who just decides to you know, drag their heels, then particularly with the crofting community right to buy, you can get very, very stuck. What happened with Great Bernera is way over on the west coast of Lewis. It is a beautiful area just around beside Uig, which is where the Lewis chessmen were found, and where it was thought, you know, legend that the Bran Seer was given his gift of second sight. I mean, that's some place, you know, one bay and all these things have actually happened on it. So it's a beautiful place. Bernera has got 250 crofters, and it's all crofting. Now, that's a key point, because the very flamboyant but quite well-liked landowner at the time, who died in 2012, Count Robin de la Lanne Mirles. He was an aristocrat. He was a friend of Ian Fleming, the writer, and apparently he was the part inspiration for James Bond, although, like the highest village in Scotland, I suspect there's probably quite a few candidates for that one. But anyway, he died in 2012 and left the island to his grandson, Ciaran, who lives in Germany with his dad, Patrick, the Count's son. So Patrick was acting as an executor till the lad turned 25. But the Count had told the islanders verbally that they should have first option on buying the land if it was ever put up for sale. So they thought, OK, once he died, they put the wheels in motion. They had a vote of all the islanders, and 85% of them turned out to vote for a community buyout. But the fly in the ointment seemed to be that Patrick, still acting as minder for the grandson, was disappointed, because the district valuer came in and put the price tag for the island at £70,000, which is, you know, he had his head turned by other islands with no crofting tenure, which were selling for nearly $1 million, and just thought, hang on a minute, you know, why am I not getting more? And people kept trying to explain to him that because all the island is held in crofts, there's nothing you can do with it. So essentially, anybody buying it, you know, they're buying nothing almost, because, you know, you can't get in and about. You can't change much. It's management, what happens on it. That's all the decision of the crofters, really, to a very large extent. So so he basically then just started to drag his heels. They tried to negotiate with him. This went on for about 3 years. Nothing basically happened. They doubled the valuation price. That was too small beer for him. And then he seemed to go into a pattern that seems somewhat redolent of another famous buyout on the Western Isles of Park, and that's spelt P-A-I-R-C, which is another Lewis estate where the landowner dragged his heels for 13 years. And the point is, for that whole time, he described himself as a willing seller. So, you know, these guys can all say that they're basically, you know, they're crossing the T's, they're dotting the I's, they're aware of the community's desires, they're consulting them, they're a willing seller. They just never get to a price. They never get to an agreement. They have money for endless court action. And the other side of it, what the community have to do to be able to use any of these rights to buy is unbelievable. They have to map the entire island. Now, yes. This is easy for the landowner, if it's been a well-managed estate, will have an absolutely accurate map of absolutely everything on the island. All the crofters have never had to draw up an they only have, you know, some idea of where their own crofts exist, but they haven't got a complete crofting a map of the island. So that takes some doing, and all they need to do is have one fence in the wrong place for it to be rejected.
Yeah.
And that's how Park went along. Every little mistake back, you know, tossed back. There's lots of people argue you should only be able to do that twice as a landowner, and that's your lot, because, you know, each time you should be able to see the full extent of any sort of problems. But then, just as another fly in the ointment, it seems that whilst they were gallantly working their way through mapping gates, fences, ditches, you know, stuff, a new piece of legislation by the Scottish Government, the Community Empowerment Act of 2016, made even more new hurdles, with even more careful mapping required, and the announcement that about 25 crofters couldn't vote because their houses were on land that had been given to them by a previous landowner. Why would that matter? The islanders weren't getting explanations because the Scottish Government community land team had basically stopped communicating, say the islanders, during COVID. There would be 6 months between emails, and they basically started to give up and try to think about maybe trying to target other easier to access little parcels of land instead of trying to take over their whole island. But there was a reason that they wanted the whole island. And from what I've said about the crofting, you might think, well, why bother? But the reason is that the laird, the owner still has rights, which if they want to play funny buggers, they can still basically use. I spoke to a brilliant guy, Neil James McCauley, who's lived in Burner all his life. He was working on a ferry at the time and had to race up the stairs to the top level of the ferry to keep having enough signal to explain this to me. He's got three daughters. They all went to university in Glasgow. By chance, they all married Lewis boys. They've got five children between them and they want to come home. So Neil started trying to decroft his land, which is what you have to do to then effectively have land that you could build new houses on. Almost 3 years ago, there's a mechanism for this, offering 15 times the annual rent to the estate. He did that. No reply. That's 3 years. No reply. Endless letters, endless emails. And I hope Neil won't mind me saying that in the meantime, his wife died.
Oh.
So it's increasingly important for him to be able to get his bairns back and his grandbairns back. And his sister is on the neighbouring croft. It's the same story with her. She's got three children living off the island. They've got nine youngsters between them. If you put those two families, you know, extended families together, which is what would happen if they were able to just get his signature on a piece of paper, you would end up with 14 children, which would be enough to reopen the school.
Yes.
Which shut.
Yeah.
The school shut, the shop shut, the care home shut. And part of the reason is because the type of people coming in are folk from further the parish who are older folk. Many of them are come up from south. And, you know, the demand's not there now to keep the school open. Mm-hmm. And the youngsters on the island are simply having to leave because there's no way to build affordable housing because you can't get the signature. Just that's all it is. It's a signature from this guy, this 26-year-old who lives in Germany.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, apparently, it would seem there's nothing anyone could do about it. So anyway, as you can sense, I was really beginning to get steam coming out of my ears on their behalf, partly because this is so like aspects of what happened on Egg 25 years ago. And I asked the aforementioned Scottish Government Community Land Unit, you know, why they hadn't been replying, whether or not they actually back these guys in moving forward to do a hostile buyout. And I simply got a response back saying that the Scottish Government was supporting them in their efforts and noting that they currently they're not actually eligible yet for using the Crofton Community Right to Buy, which was total news to the islanders. So, and I can't speak. I had seven questions and all I got back was a four-line answer. I'm sure a lot of journalists would say, welcome to my world, you know, because I very rarely have to go through the motions of trying to get in touch with Scottish Government press officers. But, you know, this is all they've got to say is at this point in time, the Great Burnerock community are not eligible to use the right to buy application. No explanation of why. Nothing. And in fact, I did go back to them and said by email, you realise that when I print this, this will give the impression to the landowner that they failed?
Yeah.
No answer. So I have no idea what's going on there, but happily, it seems that this has kind of alerted enough people that ought to be helping to, you know, begin to take this a bit seriously, because actually, and it is the hammer of the Nats, Brian Wilson, former MP who lives on the Western Isles, who made this point, and he's absolutely right. In 20 years, no Crofton community has successfully been able to use the Crofton community right to buy. 20 years.
Yeah.
So might somebody think that this is actually a piece of legislation that is unfit for purpose? Yeah. Yeah. If it takes that much help to have everybody, you know, standing on their hands trying to map what they're going to buy. This is what puzzles everyone. It's like, you know, buyer beware. You know, if you buy a pig and a poke, that's your problem. But, you know, the onus on having this exact mapping done is an incredibly wearing thing. So anyway, but the Burnerra chaps and chapesses are absolutely got the bit between the teeth, as well they might, because, I mean, it was 150 years ago that these guys actually had what was called the Burnerra riot, when some of the common grazing that they had traditionally was basically taken away by the estate. And there was evictions then threatened as a result of people protesting against the loss of common grazing, which is the only way to keep living. You need to have common grazing to put your beasts on. And they had a march on Stornoway and were successful. The first legal challenge to Highland landlordism in history happened because of the people of Burnerra. And it subsequently led 20 years or so later to the Crofting Acts that mean that there are people still living on that island despite the absentee landlordism that's happened in the interim. So these guys are not from stock that gives up.
No.
And I would think they'll keep going and all part their elbows.
Yeah, because the other thought that I had, that would that there was someone still in Parliament in Holyrood who actually had a significant knowledge and interest in land reform and actually getting legislation passed.
Well, yes, but that honestly, that's a pretty heavy burden to lay on Andy Whiteman. Oh, you know, I did actually speak to Andy about this. His suggestion is there should be a time limit on sales negotiations, you know, because this is just ridiculous. But there's plenty of suggestions as to quite what things could happen. There will be a new land reform bill apparently in 2023. But here's the kind of litmus test of it then. If these guys are still sitting, not even considered eligible mm-hmm. by a government unit that hasn't emailed them in 6 months, I would humbly suggest there's a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's a scandal. Absolutely a scandal. That should be the situation they're involved in. There's a lack of communication. They're not even given the dignity of a response. I think it's appalling. That's an appalling piece of treatment. And again, to discover that legislation has not been successfully used for two decades just that threw me when I read that, and it angers me again. So sorry, I'm in an angry mood, but I mean, it just seems it's these hoops that individuals and communities continually have to jump through to do the right thing when it should be made easy for them to do, and it should be or not. It shouldn't be. Well, let's examine all these stakeholders and what they've got to do. What's the right thing? What's the right thing for the people who want to save their community and what will make their community revive? That's what should be done. It should be glaringly obvious to those in power in Holyrood that's what should be done.
Because I mean, this is again the thing, as I was saying earlier about Rosa when she was speaking, of basically getting your head up and looking over the problem. Because, you know, there maybe, and this is the worst ideas, suspicions that people have, is that local authorities and the government don't want remote schools reopened.
Mm.
And that fits in with our previous conversation about the National Planning Framework 4,
yes,
which is, I think, being, you know, is being either ditched, revised or whatever as we speak, you know, was the suggestion that contained within it as the outlook for planners for the next 10, 20, mm-hmm, even 30 years. The suggestion was very strongly that you basically whip people back into the rural centres of population that are kind of semi-urban, and the rest of everybody can go swing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that's the worst thoughts everybody has, is that actually that nobody really wants them to get enough kids there to reopen that school. And this is outrageous, because you look at things on a number of fronts, the ferries, yeah, the land ownership, all these things. When you look across the examples to Norway or to anywhere else, you know, it's perfectly possible to have thriving communities on infinitely more remote land that also hasn't got half the blooming world trying to come and visit it. You know, I mean, it's so possible for this place to be viable and just brilliant. In fact, give it just a little bit of the resource and the time that Egg's had. And Egg, by the way, got nothing in terms of public, mm-hmm, money for the buyout. Just give it that time, 25 years this year with Egg, that's the face of the future. And it might be easier to bear the nonsense that these people are having if you thought that was all there was. But they can look north, they can look east, they can, yes, look south. There's buyouts everywhere around them, and those people are motoring, and they're going nowhere.
Right. Oh, gosh. I mean, and it just makes me think. I mean, we go back to what we talked about last week, and failures of systems, and just to lighten it a little bit, I must apologize. I mean, I went down a punning a rabbit hole when I systems all fall down, and fall down. I mean, I should have done it in Scots, which should have been systems all fall down, you know, and it might have made a bit more sense. And you did, it did depend upon the knowledge of a American heavy rock band, System of a Down, as well. So I promise I will not be as obscure again in terms of my references. Just a little thing, a recommendation I can make to people. I went to the movies to see Operation Mincemeat, which for people of a certain generation is a remake of the Man Who Never Was, starring Clifton Webb, and thoroughly enjoyable. And it was almost a throwback, Leslie. It was a war movie done almost in 1950s style. And it was nuanced. It was interesting. There was barely anybody in to see it. But I recommend it to people. It was thoughtful. It was intelligent. And it was complex. And I recommend it if anybody is looking for a cinema visit. That Operation Mincemeat. Dreadful name.
Nice one. Well, yeah, I've been. I'm afraid, as an Outlander kind of fan, there wasn't an episode this week, so I find myself, ooh, going back to the beginning and watching the first couple of episodes again, which is actually extraordinary, because they're 5 years, 6 years older as actors. You know, they're so, mm-hmm, fresh. I know there's been a lot of makeup and so on applied, but by gum, it just shows you we're all. We're all getting older.
Good. Yes, and not only are individuals and people getting older, but yes, folks, credit cards get old as well, and debit cards get old as well. So this is just a wee reminder to anyone, just to have a check. I will be sending emails out about this, because some subscribers, I mean, some people have cancelled, and I fully understand that within the framework of your people's budgets just now. But some people have fallen behind in terms of the fact that their credit or debit cards have gone out of date. And all you need to do is go to leslieriddick.com/podcast and manage subscriptions. And as I said, that what I will be doing, I'll be sending emails out to people about it. And please, please, if you feel that you can't continue to subscribe, do not feel embarrassed about it. Do not feel worried about it. We're just delighted if you continue to listen. And the podcasts themselves will always and everywhere be free to listen to. So,
amen to that.
Yeah. And on that administrative note, we'll see you next week, Chucks.